A new survey published this week by the personal finance website Bankrate finds that about 1 in 5 workers reported not saving any income. And recent research by the Pew Charitable Trusts found that about 2 in 5 households lack the cash to cover a $2,000 expense. Up against this data, it's very relevant to talk about how to strategically use our tax refund on this edition of On Your Money. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Kevin McKinley is in the house. He is a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money LLC. Hi there, Kevin.
Hello, Kate.
And if you have a personal finance question, you can run it by Kevin. Call in at 800-642-1234. You can email your question to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. Well, Kevin, once your tax returns are submitted, the waiting period begins for that refund, that coveted refund.
It's an important time of year for many taxpayers if they have been fortunate enough to prepare and submit their taxes. About 70% of them are waiting for some refund from the federal government that averages about $2,900 in size, and it's a smaller portion and a smaller size of refund for state income taxpayers.
So how soon are those refunds going to land in checking accounts?
Well, both the state and the federal tax departments are still working very hard to make sure that the forms that they've received are the ones actually submitted by the people. There still is a lot of fraudulent tax return filing where someone will steal your Social Security number, birthdate information, make up a bunch of numbers on the return, claim a big credit, and hope that they can get the check before you or the revenue departments figure out that it's a fraudulent return. But they are putting measures in place, and they're getting better at catching those fraudulent returns from the federal revenue department. If you e-file and direct deposit, you can expect your check in less than 3 weeks, usually. If you use paper, you can expect it in about 6 weeks. The state of Wisconsin has about the same terms, but both departments say that you might get some delays because it could be 12 weeks or more if you filed for the earned income tax credit or the additional child tax credit. That's a common tax credit that people use to file fraudulent returns and try to get it back, so that's going to be getting more scrutiny. And if you want to check the status of your refund, you can go to the IRS Where's My Refund site, or with the state of Wisconsin has a site called Refund123. Now make sure you're looking at the proper sites, because you will need to enter your Social Security number, your filing status, and you will need to know the exact amount of the refund amount that you're claiming.
Is it better to get a refund or wait until tax day and pay what you owe?
It's human beings being who we are. It is better to get the refund. We enjoy that. It feels like found money, and it does force you to save some money by putting some of your paycheck aside, or your income if you're retired, in the form of that withholding. And it also helps you avoid penalties and having to file quarterly estimates if you do underpay your income taxes. But if you have better use for the money, it might be better to reduce your whole withholding and instead use the funds to pay off high interest credit card debt, maybe invest and save for retirement, or set up a rainy day fund, because when it's with the IRS, it's difficult to get it back from them in the time between when the withholding takes place and when you get your refund. But again, if you reduce your withholding, make sure you have the money set aside by April 15th of next year. Now, one thing that's happened, Kate, we've talked a lot about the new tax code that took effect in January 1st of 2018. Mm-hmm. And because tax brackets will likely be lower for many earners, you can also reduce your withholding right now and not worry about underpaying. So in a few weeks, we're going to talk about how people can do that.
So what do most people do with their refunds?
Yeah, GoBankingRates.com did a survey of about 5,000 taxpayers, and they found 43% of them are going to put the money into savings, 36% are going to use it to pay off debt, 10% are going to use it to save for a vacation. Only 6% by the definition of the survey, use it to splurge on something unneeded. And 5% are going to spend the money on something they've been waiting on, probably car repairs, or maybe they've got a home improvement thing. But what you should do is try to build up at least 3 months' worth of living expenses in cash. And for most people, that's going to be well over the $2,900 average amount from their federal funds. So that's a good start, though, to get that money socked aside. And then, like our many people in our survey here, try to pay off any debt, especially if it exceeds 10%. People should actually, at this point in the world and their lives, if you have credit card debt that does exceed 10% in interest, you should probably focus on paying that off rather than saving for retirement or putting it towards other debt. There's a feature that you can use to direct deposit your federal tax refund to an IRA or a Roth IRA maybe, or you can even use it to buy one of our favorite safe investments, Series I savings bonds, directly from the government. And if you can stand listening to the show for the rest of the hour, at the end of it, for our website of the week, we're going to tell you a way that you can use your refund to possibly win some free money.
Kevin McKinley is the managing member of McKinley Money LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin McKinley does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services discussed are suitable for any investor. Investors should consult with their financial advisors prior to making any investment decisions. With that, what money question is on your mind? Run it by Kevin at 800-642-1234. You can email it to onyourmoney@wpr.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Tim is waiting in Appleton. Hi, Tim.
Good morning, and thank you for taking my call. I have an insurance policy that is a combination home and automobile. And I was wondering if I should be shopping around to see if I'm getting the best or a good deal. My agent says stick with him because I've received some discounts. And the internet says shop around. And I would really like your advice.
Yeah, Tim, you're correct in your instinct. And this is one case where the internet is correct as well. Of course, most agents are going to say, especially if they're what's called a captive agent, meaning that they work for a specific insurance company, they are going to say, hey, stick with me because I lose the income from your premiums if you go someplace else. And there could definitely be a possibility that, you know, the insurance companies aren't stupid. They don't just say, well, we're going to charge as much as we possibly can and regardless of what your other options are. So what I would say is to shop around for a couple reasons, one of two things will happen. Either you will find a better price policy, and maybe it's one that offers better coverage or for the same price of what you're currently paying, or your agent will be proven correct that you are getting a good deal already. It's a comfortable relationship. You trust the agent, you trust the company, and you'll feel better about it. But when it comes to insurance, especially auto insurance, there's a reason you should shop around and get quotes from other companies periodically. It's because there were a few articles probably a year or so ago that were released that showed some auto insurance companies price their policies based on how likely they think it is you are going to shop around. Meaning if they think you're going to look around for other companies, they're going to charge you less. And if they don't think you will do that and you're kind of stuck in the relationship, they're going to try to milk a little bit more money out of you if you can. So even just applying at other companies sends a notice to the other, to your current insurance company that you are shopping around, and it might lead to lower prices from your current policy and provider. But no, I think it's a very good idea to do it.
Tim, thank you so much for the call. Andy from Madison is asking, hi, Kevin, just wondering, what's the best way to use credit cards to boost your credit score? Is it better to use it to make a single purchase on the credit card per month, such as a tank of gas, or make multiple small purchases on it per month? Also, do you have to let the balance roll over to the next month before paying it off so the credit companies see the purchase, or can you pay it off immediately when you get home?
It's a good question. It's worth paying attention to your purchases and your payments as it relates to your credit score. Again, your credit score is just a figure that adds up several different components of the type of credit you have, any new credit you've obtained, the length of your credit, and the payment history, and the credit utilization. It combines all them together with hopefully an easy score that lenders can use to see what kind of borrower you will be if they choose to lend money to you. The payment history and credit utilization parts, which relates to Andy's question, that constitutes 65% of your credit score. So this is affected by how the money comes into the credit card account in terms of paying it off and how it goes out in terms of charging it.
So what would you say is the best way to manipulate charges and payments to boost your score?
Prove you can use it and then prove you can pay it off quickly. Go ahead and charge it up, but then pay it off as soon as possible. Even if it's something that has only happened for a few days in the account, the credit bureaus will actually see those charges and show up as a balance on the account. And by paying it off very quickly, it allows you to hopefully avoid interest expenses, and it keeps more credit available for future use or for emergencies. And you want to keep the utilization very low, meaning you don't want to carry a balance. It's not a good idea to do that. It usually doesn't help boost your credit score up.
Why would anyone want to have a balance on their credit card accounts?
Yeah, you're paying interest, so you're a better customer for the lenders. I guess that sometimes people come to me and they say, I've never had a penny of debt in my life, and my credit score is 790, which is very good, but my brother-in-law, he has a mortgage, and he's had credit cards, and he's got a car loan. His is 820. Why is that? Some of it might be that he has proven that he can take on debt and that he can manage it effectively, and you haven't because you've never had any debt whatsoever. And so the credit bureaus don't have any indication that you can get debt and then use it effectively. But it's kind of a myth that you need to carry a balance to boost up your credit score, because the interest costs far outweigh any value that you'd receive from the higher score. And again, you don't want to exceed 30% of your available credit on your credit card in terms of carrying a balance, because then that can start to damage your credit score. So if you have a $10,000 credit limit on a card, you want to keep that revolving balance at least below $3,000, 30% of your available credit, because anything over that starts to trigger a red flag by the credit bureaus.
You're with us for On Your Money. Kevin McKinley is a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. If you have a question about your finances, call in with your question at 800-642-1234. You can send your personal finance question by email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Later this hour, we'll take a closer look at health savings accounts. HSA assets reached $45 billion by the end of 2017. That was a 22% year-over-year increase. We'll find out how to make the most of an HSA. We'll be back in just a moment here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for On Your Money. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Financial planner Kevin McKinley is here. He's managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. Coming up, we'll look at how funding a health savings account is a way to reduce a tax rate and ramp up savings for medical treatments, perhaps even retirement. But first, if you have a personal finance question, call it in at 800-642-1234. You can send your money question via email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. David emailed, said, you often hear it suggested that you should save 20% of your annual incomes. What exactly does that mean? 20% into your retirement fund, savings account, or both?
Yeah, well, That's a rule of thumb, and that's a great rule of thumb. Americans don't generally save that amount of money into any kind of savings vehicle. That means if you're earning $50,000 gross per year, if you're saving 20%, hopefully you're socking $10,000 per year aside. And that's a good number. And what I'd actually prefer is you kind of do a double-barreled approach to that. If you're able to save that amount of money, is to save $5,000 a year in your retirement and then another $5,000 into more near-term accessible vehicles like your savings account, maybe a Roth IRA, because with a Roth IRA, you can pull the contributions back out whenever you want at any time with no taxes or penalties whatsoever. And so you're kind of making sure that there's money there when you're 60, and then there's money there for 6 months from now that you can pull aside. And again, 20% is a phenomenal figure to save. If you can even get to 10% savings, that's fantastic. And what that does, it's not just about getting the money set aside. It's about learning to live on a little less. If you earn $50,000 of gross income, but you're saving 20% of it, you're actually living on $40,000. And I've been a financial planner now for 30 years. And when people call us up and say, we'd like to work with you. The first thing we do is send out a questionnaire so we can get a better picture of where they're at, if they're appropriate for us, and if we're the right people for them. And there's one thing that I look at first and foremost when I open up those returned questionnaires. It's not how much money they have or where it's invested or even how much money they make. I look at what they spend every single month, because that's a very good indicator of not only where we need to invest and how much more they need to save and how long it's going to take to be financially independent, but it also is an indication of kind of where their heads are at. And if you live in, you know, rural or semi-rural Wisconsin, and I see a number there that, you know, you're spending $15,000 per month or something, even if you have a high income to justify that, I kind of almost hope that you have an illegitimate drug problem, because there's really no way that you can spend that every single month on something that is, that's a basic need for people. Now, if you're living in Manhattan or Los Angeles or a more expensive location, sure, it's easy to get up to that $8,000 to $12,000 a month, especially if you have kids. But yes, setting that money aside, 20% is a great target, but 10% is where you should start.
Let's go to Nancy now in Star Prairie. Hi, Nancy.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. Go ahead.
Okay. I was discussing with some friends over the weekend about credit cards being compromised with online purchases. And someone suggested that you get one card that only has a line of credit for $500 and use that only for your online purchasing. So if your card is compromised, they're only going to get the $500 and not try for the bigger purchases. Now, I'm wondering if I should contact my current credit card companies and ask for another card for $500. I don't want to damage my credit card or my credit rating, because it's really, it's excellent in the excellent category.
Sure, okay. Nancy, yeah, that's a good concern. And, you know, are you talking about, you're talking about credit cards, not debit cards, correct?
Credit card.
Okay. Well, the good news with credit cards is that they are much more secure to use than debit cards, because a debit card is just like a bank account. And if you don't check a debit card charge and it goes unnoticed for more than 30 days or longer, and then all of a sudden you find out about it, you may be out of luck, because the IRS or the credit card company, rather the debit card company, will say, well, you know, they just took money out of your account. You didn't notice it. You didn't report it. Therefore, there's nothing we can do about it. The credit card companies, on the other hand, generally your liability legally is limited just to the first $50. And most credit companies realize that that's such an insignificant amount, they can get better PR, customer relations, whatever, by just saying, hey, you have no liability with it. But if you are concerned about that, sure, you can definitely request a new credit card. And if you have a good credit score, the extra credit card isn't going to hurt you that much. Even when you apply for it, you might only find a point or two drop in your credit score. And after you've returned to your normal behavior of not taking out new debt and handling this new credit card responsibly, then your credit score will go back to where it was. And in fact, it might even go up a little bit, because the amount of credit that you have available but don't use has grown as well. So sure, Nancy, I don't think that's a bad idea at all. Just pay attention to, you know, annual fees and interest rates if you do carry a balance.
Nancy, thanks so much for the call. Let's now go to Milwaukee, where Jimmy is waiting. Hi, Jimmy.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call. I got a question about keeping my revolving credit below 30% of my total credit cards. And I was wondering if the credit cards from stores like Home Depot and Lowe's, or, you know, I have a credit with PayPal, do they count towards the total credit that I need to calculate the 30% off of? And I also, like, my wife is the primary account holder on some of the credit cards, and I'm an authorized user on them. Do they count towards my total as well?
Yeah, usually they will, Jim. It's a good question, but it's each account itself. It's nice to have all of your debt below 30% of what you can charge, but it's any card you have where you're more than the 30% limit, that card in and of itself will affect you. So you might have let's say, two cards where one has a $10,000 limit and the other one has a $5,000 limit, let's say. And on the $5,000 limit, let's say $4,000 charged up on that. That's 80% of the available credit on that, but let's say you have zero on the 10%. Well, the overall ratio is well below 30% between your two available credit amounts, but it's much higher than the 30% on one of them. So that's the one that's going to hurt you more so than if you just carried, you know, 31% across the board. Like if you had $5,000 total between those two hypothetical accounts, then that one would hurt you less than having the $4,000 on one on the short card and then nothing on the big card.
Jimmy, thanks so much for the call. And Ron is also waiting in Milwaukee. Ron, hi, go ahead.
Hi, I would like to know just how accurate are the online websites such as Credit Karma and Sesame Credit and so forth, because I've had problems when I check with that with the Equifax account.
Mm-hmm. You get a different number from Equifax, the credit bureau, than you do from these other free sites, right, Ron?
Yeah, it's a great big difference.
Yeah, and I'm betting the free sites are lower than what you're seeing from the credit bureau, right?
Well, I haven't. When I go to the websites, they were running pretty steadily.
Mm-hmm.
And when Equifax was hacked a year ago, 4 months later, my credit score through them on Credit Karma jumped up about 120 points.
Okay.
And then about 4 months, 5-6 months later, it just suddenly just dropped back way down. And when I call them up to, because of a discrepancy, they kind of straightened it out. It jumped back up again, according to Credit Karma, and now it dropped back down again.
Yeah, I think the Credit Karma and the Credit Sesame, those sites are useful because they're free, and you can check them whenever you want at no cost. And it gives you a pretty good idea of where you're at. Now, what they do then is after you give them permission to look at your credit score and your credit information, they then take that and they offer you usually loans, often credit cards, or maybe you have a car loan out that they think you'll qualify for that has a lower interest rate. That's how those sites make their money. That doesn't make them bad or something you should stay away from. It just means you have to be aware. Anytime someone gives you something for free, you're the customer. And that's the case in these credit free credit score parts. The good news is, for better or for worse, their numbers that they have for you, Ron, that's not the ultimate number that determines if you get a loan. That's just an idea. And there can be different kinds of credit reports. There can be different credit scores depending on where you're going and what kind of where you're going for the loan and what kind of loan you're trying to get. And then even what bureau they use. There's different scores for auto loans and home loans, et cetera. And so take those scores you're getting from Credit Karma, Credit Sesame, et cetera, with a grain of salt. It's a very good indication of probably where you're at, and you may even find some good offers there. But the ones that come from the three big credit bureaus, those are the ones that lenders actually use to decide if they're going to give you a loan and what they'll charge you on it.
Appreciate the call, the question, Ron. And now let's bring in Nancy in Grafton. Hi, Nancy.
Morning. My husband died last summer, and now we have a really large family, and now I have to go in and take care of all this business. You know, I got to do the income tax. Is that filed jointly? Can you deduct funeral expenses? It's a mess. So, and I've got some good people I have to talk to, you know, one today. And how do you handle all this stuff?
Right. Well, I'm sorry for your loss, Nancy. And this is kind of the, you know, it's negative icing on a bad cake, meaning that not only do you have to grieve and go through the loss of a loved one, but then you also have all this paperwork afterwards. And if things were different, I'd like to see some kind of place you could just go and hand your big stack of paperwork over to that person and that party, and whether it's legal or tax or investments or whatever, those people just take care of everything and allow you to go through all the other stuff like the post-funeral issues and everything that you have to do with those. So when you said you're talking with some good people, I'm very happy to hear that. is it a tax preparer or a CPA?
One is a tax preparer. We've been dealing with him for a long time. Mm-hmm. And another one is an attorney that we're going to see regarding, you know, our property and everything that was on both of our names. And now now it's just me. And, you know, we have 14 kids. Mm. And there's 13 of them around yet. And how do you divide all that stuff up, you know, so that when I'm gone, then the kids don't have to go through all this mess like I'm going through now.
Right. No, that's a really good point. And especially your point is very salient, Nancy, because the law is pretty clear. If spouses are married to each other and don't have any other wishes, it's relatively easy to move money and property from one deceased partner to another. It's much more of a hassle to bring it down to the next generation after you pass away. And especially because when you have that many kids, you've got different relationships, you've got spouses of those kids, you've got grandkids, I'm guessing you may even have great-grandkids, and it makes it harder to figure out. The best thing to do, in my opinion, Nancy, is if you want to, is to split everything up equally in percentages, and especially if it is an easily dividable account like an IRA, you don't have to do dollars if you don't want to. You can just say, well, let's say you have three heirs or four heirs, you want to get your retirement account. You can split that up 25% apiece. And the good news is while you are alive and of sound mind and body, you can go back in whenever you want and change those allocations and change your estate plan with relatively little cost and hassle for it. But you want to make sure everything is in place while you are alive, because after you're gone, that's when people start fighting for it, and the less clear your designations are, the more likely it is that not only will there be a lot of animosity, but there'll be a lot of cost, because everybody starts hiring their own lawyers, and pretty soon they've paid the lawyers more than what they were expecting to inherit from the estate.
Nancy, thank you so much for the call. You are with us for On Your Money. Financial planner Kevin McKinley is here. He's managing member of McKinley Money LLC. If you have a personal finance question, call it in at 800-642-1234. You can ask your money question via email to onyourmoney@wpr.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. We've been covering financial moves that need to be made in the next few weeks. What's today's topic, Kevin?
Yeah, we are going to talk about health savings account, HSAs. 18 million Americans right now participate in a high deductible health plan, and then they use the HSA as a vehicle to help pay for that deductible if and when they incur some medical expenses. So you have to have a high deductible plan on which you qualify. It can be your own, or it can be your employer's if you are employed. And then what happens is you make a tax deductible contribution to that HSA. So if you put, let's say, $5,000 into a health savings account, that reduces your taxable income by $5,000. So it saves you about, let's just say, $1,000 or so, maybe in state and federal income taxes. And then if and when you incur qualified medical expenses that otherwise would have to be hit with a deductible, you can pull it out tax-free from that HSA to pay for it.
So what happens if HSA owners don't have enough expenses to use up their annual contribution to the HSA?
Yeah, that's a problem that's slowly going away. When these first came out, they made the mistake of using an acronym of HSA, which sounded a lot like FSA in the mind of many people, a flexible spending account. Mm. And with a flexible spending account, as you probably know, that is a use it or lose it proposition. If you don't lose it use the money in the account by a certain date, either the end of the year or some of the accounts have a March deadline, the subsequent March, the money goes away. And so people were very nervous about putting money in there for expenses they weren't sure if they were going to incur. The HSA is not a use it or lose it proposition. Any unused money that you have in the HSA at the end of the year rolls over to the next year, and it can be used for future expenses in subsequent years. Or in retirement, you might want to pull it out. And if you pull it out and use it for qualified expenses, like, let's say, long-term care insurance premiums, it can still be tax-free. And then even if you don't use it for qualified expenses, once you are 65, any unused funds in an HSA becomes an IRA, where you can pull the money out and use it in retirement. And yes, it's taxable income, but most people are in a very low tax bracket in retirement. So you can get it out without a penalty and pay very little in taxes on it.
So what do you consider are the pluses and minuses of an HSA account?
Well, the pluses are you really can save money four ways by using them. One is because you're going with a high deductible policy, you hopefully have lower premiums than if you had a standard policy. You get that tax break on the initial deposit. It can be invested within the HSA, so there's no taxes on the earnings in the account, and then it's either will come out tax-free, which will save you some money, or you pull it out in retirement, and again, because you're probably in a lower income tax bracket in retirement, you'll pay less in taxes on it then than you saved when you deposited the money into it. The downsides, though, are you have to have the money to contribute to the HSA, and as you've discussed early in the show, Kate, people just don't have generally thousands and thousands of dollars lying around just waiting to slide into the HSA. You also can't invest as aggressively in an HSA. You might need that money this year, next year, or the year after, and so therefore you should be more conservative with it. And the good news is it'll probably be there. The bad news is you're not going to earn a higher rate of long-term returns that you would if you were able to take more risk with it. And then finally, there are penalties to the HSA if you just pull it out and use it on non-qualified expenses. You'll pay taxes on all the money that you withdraw. It'll be taxable as ordinary income, and you'll pay a 10% penalty on it as well.
So who would you consider to be the best candidates for an HSA?
You know, it's kind of a almost a barbell approach. I mean, people in lower income situations and then people in higher income situations are usually the best candidates for these. First of all, you're better off, the healthier you are and the less likely you are to need the money, the better are you off to use an HSA. And then for lower income people, we've talked about this before and we're going to talk about it again in a few weeks. Younger people who are relatively healthy might be better off in the long run. They're trying to figure out if they should save for their health care or save for retirement. They're probably better off just using the HSA because between the combined tax break on the HSA plus the lower premiums, if they have to cover any of their premium costs, they're better off than socking that money into a retirement account and then paying higher insurance as well. Higher income people could be already maxed out on any pre-tax retirement savings they have, like a 401k or a 403b. And so this is one more way for them to not only save money on the premiums, but get more pre-tax money working for them. And then again, it'll be tax-free if they use it for qualified expenses and taxed at a lower rate in retirement.
Tackling your personal finance questions, it's On Your Money. You can send your question by email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Call in that question for Kevin McKinley at 800-642-1234. You can also tweet us at WPR Mornings. Let's go to Rebecca now, joining us from Iron Ridge. Good morning, Rebecca.
Good morning.
Go ahead.
Thank you for taking my call. My mother passed away in late 2016. And her taxes were filed and when her accounts were closed and the taxes were paid on her property. It went, no property, on her money. And so we inherited, the children inherited money in December of 2017. And I was wondering if we have to pay tax, federal tax on that, state tax on that.
Well, you
mean the taxes were already paid.
Was it just normal assets or was it like a IRA or an annuity, Rebecca?
There was some life insurance.
Okay.
There was some. Well, I don't even really know. I think possibly an investment.
Okay.
Maybe stocks, and then. My understanding was that the taxes were paid on any money she made when
the gains
when the accounts were closed.
Right. Yeah, it's a tricky situation because first of all, the taxes were probably like you say were paid by the estate, but the rate could be different for the estate than it was for you. And then it's highly dependent upon the type of asset, like the life insurance that you mentioned, Rebecca. That's generally tax-free, so there shouldn't be any taxes on life insurance distributions. And there shouldn't be any inheritance taxes either, unless it was a really huge estate, up, you know, in the $5 to $10 million range or beyond. Where you might get taxed is if any securities were sold and between the time that you inherited it and you selling it, or if there were distributions made from a taxable account like an IRA or a tax-deferred annuity. And so what I would do is, Rebecca, do you usually do your own taxes or do you have someone who helps you?
I do my own.
Okay. This might be a good year to look for a tax preparer or a CPA because it's a very tricky situation depending on how the size of the estate, paying this person maybe $300 to $800, depending on the complexity of the situation and the preparer, might be worth it to make sure that you're not only filing it properly and you don't run into problems down the road, but you also are getting everything that you're entitled to for not just the inheritance, but also your other tax situation. So I'd recommend that you look for a tax preparer, and you probably want to do that sooner rather than later because we are basically less than 1 month away from the tax due bill. So I'd contact the tax person.
Rebecca, thanks so much for the call. You're listening to On Your Money. Kevin McKinley is our go-to financial planner. He's managing member of McKinley Money LLC. Do you have a money question on your mind? You can join in at 800-642-1234 or email it to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Have you put off doing your taxes with just a few weeks left before the deadline? We'll get some tips for getting help on preparation. Stay with us for more On Your Money here on the Ideas Network. Millions of Americans prefer to prepare their tax return themselves, but even DIYers appreciate a little help once in a while. We'll get some advice on where to find that help on our taxes. You're with us for On Your Money. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Kevin McKinley is a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money LLC. If you have a personal finance question you want to run by Kevin, you can join in at 800-642-1234. You can email it to onyourmoney@wpr.org or you can tweet it at WPR Mornings. Let's go to Kessler now, joining us from Green Bay. Hi, Kessler.
Hello.
Go ahead.
I have some money from a previous employer that I guess I was not staying current with. I didn't realize I had it, and I got a statement in the mail. I had about $1,900. And I was kind of curious. I had a couple different recommendations of what I could do with it as far as rolling it into this employer, or some people told me things of penny stocks and such, and I'm not real familiar with the stock market, so I guess I was kind of looking for options.
Yeah, Kessler, good question. Congratulations on finding out that you had money that you didn't think you had. The penny stocks thing, that's no different than going to a casino. And actually, the casino might be better because you find out right away how much money you lost. With penny stocks, usually it drags it out into nothing until you finally lose it. And like a casino, people who say you should invest in penny stocks, especially if they're just friends or family members or coworkers, they're kind of like those people who go to the casino and always come back and saying how much they won. And they never tell you about how much they lose. So I would be very averse to putting it in penny stocks. I would do one of two things with it. I would either leave it in the current plan, if you can, or you said you're working at a new employer now, Kessler?
Yeah, I mean, I've been here like 8 years, and that's why when I got the statement last year, at the end of last year, it was kind of a pleasant surprise. But yeah, it's been in there for at least, 10 years, I guess.
Okay. Yeah, if you have a new employer and the new employer allows it, you can actually roll that money into your new plan and then invest it accordingly. And if you do it properly, it'll be tax-free to you, meaning you won't pay any taxes on it. There's no penalties for it. What you want to do, Kessler, is you want to move it as a custodian-to-custodian transaction. And you contact your new plan first and see, first of all, is it allowed to move money from a previous employer's plan into this one? And it probably is. Then after you find out if it is, say, okay, what forms need to be filled out? And hopefully the new custodian can actually do the work for you, help you fill out the forms, and make sure that it gets transferred over appropriately. And then it's in one place, and it's a good place for long-term savings. And there are aggressive investments, Kessler. How old are you?
34.
Okay, so you have 25 or 30 years at least until you're going to be retiring, and so you have a long time to wait for this. So rather than invest in penny stocks, what I'd like to see you do is pick an aggressive stock mutual fund within your new employer 401k to invest it in. And again, that's going to give you more return probably and more risk than you can stand, but you can afford to do that because you have a long time until you're going to be needing the money, and you can add to it as prices go down in the future. But just understand that when you put into an aggressive stock fund, there's a chance it can go down 30, 40, 50% in a bad year. But over several decades, generally, that's where you're likely to get your best performance.
Kessler, good luck and thank you. Let's go to Bill now, calling from Janesville. Hi, Bill.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning.
I've been part of the health savings account so long that it was actually a medical savings account years ago. My question is why is that account that the money's held in earns better interest rates than normal savings account? They've always had a better interest rate.
Yeah, it depends on the provider. Is it at a bank, Bill, the HSA, or is it like an insurance company?
No, it's at a bank. It's always been at banks. When, like I said, when I was part of the medical savings account system, there were limited banks that could do it. But
right.
It's always earned really good interest, better than any normal bank/savings/checking account. And I was always curious why.
Sure. Define really good. Like, what's it paying right now, roughly?
Oh, off the top of my head, I don't know, but it's usually... It can be, I used to see it be 1.5 to 2% more than a normal.
That wouldn't surprise me. Like if you were getting 0.5% on a savings account from the same bank, you might be able to get 1.5 to 2% on the account from the other bank, from the HSA account, right?
Yes. What's okay. The logic behind it, Payne?
Well, it's not about, it's just that the, you know, if I open up a bank and I say, hey, I have checking and savings accounts, I could take in millions and millions of dollars the first day if I pay too much for it. And if I can't earn that interest rate by lending it out or investing it, I'm going to be in trouble. Whereas when you have an HSA, it's still a relatively small dollar amount. You know, the maximum a family can contribute to an HSA is $6,500. And they typically don't have a lot of money flying in and flying out, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars. So they might be able to offer a little bit higher interest rate because they're not going to take a lot of dollars into it. And that money is probably going to stay there unless it's not going to be in a competitive environment where it's going to be coming in and out quickly. Therefore, they're more likely to be able to use the money for the long term, invest it, and then earn a slightly higher return on it, and therefore pay a slightly higher rate of return on it.
Bill, thank you so much for the call. If you have a personal finance question, you can call it in at 800-642-1234. Send it via email to onyourmoney@wpr.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. My mama told me you better shop around. If you're looking for help filing your taxes, there are lots of places to go for little or no cost. Is that right, Kevin?
That is, and you can start with the good people at the IRS. Go to their website at irs.gov. It's getting better and better in trying to provide the information that you need to accurately file your taxes. And you can also try the phone number, 800-829-1040. But even the IRS themselves say you can probably plan on waiting about 15 minutes on average to reach a person. You can also go to the local offices, although due to cutbacks, there are fewer local offices around and the hours have been shortened. So you're probably better off going online or trying the phone first and seeing if you can get help that way.
But they won't prepare your return for you.
Not yet. And I've asked every single year. I said, you know what? You just take what you need, but fill this out and do it correctly for it. You can find a person if you qualify. The VITA, V-I-T-A, that's the Volunteer Income Tax Association. They have volunteers who help low to mid-income people in the military, seniors, complete their taxes. And then TCE stands for Tax Counseling for the Elderly, same type of program. And a lot of these sites are affiliated with AARP. And so we'll have links up to those websites where you can find a person in your area to take your form down and say, you know more about this than I do. For no cost, can you help me fill this out and do it accurately? And we'll have the website at onyourmoney.com to find those locations in a particular area.
Is it still possible to file your income taxes for free?
Yeah, there is the free file program where several electronic filing companies, private companies, kind of make a deal with the IRS where they say, I'll tell you what, we'll offer our software up to certain lower income individuals for free, and then hopefully they'll higher income individuals that don't qualify for this will pay us a little bit of money to use our program. Now, to get the free one, you have to have an adjusted gross income of $66,000 or less in 2017. And that actually is probably lower than the median income, or excuse me, higher than the median income for American households. And so a lot of people will qualify for this. The drawbacks of it are if you're over, then you can use this service that it's just fillable forms where you have to do the math yourself. They probably won't file your state tax return, but you can go to irs.gov to find all the free file providers out there. We'll have the link at onyourmoney.com. Or H&R Block has gone together with United Way and put up a really nice site, very easy to use, at myfreetaxes.com. Again, that's myfreetaxes.com.
And what about people who don't qualify for the free online filing?
You know, it's never been a better time to use one of the software programs to help you with your taxes, in part because one of the biggest reasons that people get audited or get flagged from the IRS in review of their returns is when they do it by pencil and paper, they make a math mistake. And the math doesn't add up. The IRS says, hey, you said this number on line 18 or whatever, but on line 43, we've got this number. What's the deal? And so that keeps you from getting your refund, and the software will help you protect you from doing that. Smart Asset, the website, did a review of all the low-cost programs out there. They said that TurboTax is the best one. I'd agree with that. TaxSlayer is the cheapest. And then they said if you want the assurance of knowing there's a human being you can talk to either locally or on the phone, H&R Block is the best software to use online. And most of these programs run from about maybe $50 to $100 or so. And I just think it's really a great investment to help make sure you get your taxes done. They're very intuitive, meaning they ask you questions much in the same way a human being would. And then once you fill the answers out, again, for $50 to $100, you can submit your file electronically. If you have it direct deposited, it's usually only a matter of a few weeks until you get your refund.
And I know we're running out of time, Kevin, but Austin in Eau Claire has a quick question. Austin, go ahead. Oh, there we go.
Oh, good. All right. So I'm 20 years old. I'm thinking about starting an IRA. I don't have a whole lot to invest right away, so I was wondering if you have any suggestions on places I should go.
Yeah, Austin, good for you. It's great. Starting with a few thousand dollars at 20 is like starting with $10,000 at 50. So good for you. You want to open up a Roth IRA, though, because you don't get a tax break on it, but you can pull the contributions back out whenever you want. And what I would do is, depending on the dollar amount, you might just want to go to your local bank or credit union to get the deposit in by the deadline, or go to one of the bigger providers like Vanguard, Schwab, or Fidelity and see if they can offer you one and do it online that way.
What is the website of the week?
The website of the week is SaveYourRefund.com. It's a Commonwealth, a nonprofit in Boston, and the Consumer Federation of America have put together to say if you show that you've deposited all or part of your refund in a savings or retirement account, or you buy a savings bond, you qualify for a chance to win cash prizes of over several hundred dollars. SaveYourRefund.com, and we'll have a link to that website at our website, OnYourMoney.com, later on today.
And for more words before we go.
Spend less, have more.
Kevin McKinley is a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money LLC. On Your Money can be heard on the Ideas Network Tuesday mornings at 8 and rebroadcast Saturdays at noon. And this edition of On Your Money was produced by Michelle Johnson with technical direction from Michael Deringer. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.